You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Manifestations of Karma. This is Lecture 4, which is entitled Karma in Relation to the Curability and Incurability of Diseases, given in Hamburg on the 19th of May, 1910. With regard to the two themes of today's lecture, the curability and incurability of illnesses, clearer ideas and concepts more acceptable to humanity will prevail when the concepts of karma and karmic connections in life will have been accepted by wider circles. It is a fact that there have been widely divergent views on the question of the curability and incurability of illnesses in the various centuries. And we don't need to go back very far to see how tremendously these concepts have changed. We find a time at the turning point between the Middle Ages and modern times, about the 16th to the 17th century, when the idea gradually gained ground that the various forms of illness could be strictly delimited, and that for every disease there was some sort of herb or mixture by which it could be cured without fail. This belief lasted for a long time, even into the 19th century. When we as laymen, or as people who have absorbed present-day ideas on the subject, read accounts of medical treatments from the end of the 18th or the beginning of the 19th centuries, and for some time later, we are astounded at all the remedies and recipes in general use at that time. Teas, mixtures, more dangerous medicines, bloodletting, and so on. Yet it was also in the 19th century that this approach was reversed into its exact opposite in medical circles, and indeed in distinguished medical circles. I may add that I came across a great variety of these opposing views in my younger years. There was plenty of opportunity to witness such phenomena in the context of the, quote, nihilistic school of medicine, close quote, which was started in Vienna around the middle of the 19th century and won more and more favor. A radical change in the views on curability and incurability set in when the renowned physician Dietl brought to light his findings on the process of pneumonia and similar diseases. From all kinds of observations, he arrived at the conclusion that fundamentally there was no real effect to be noticed from the use of various remedies on the course of one disease or another. Under the influence of Dietl's school, the young doctors of that day acquired a way of thinking in relation to the healing value of the remedies, which had been used for centuries, that almost outdid what is conveyed in the well-known saying, "When the cock crows on the dung heap, the weather will change, or it will remain as it is." They were of the opinion that it made little difference to the course of any disease whether one administered a certain remedy or not. Dietl managed to produce some statistics which were quite convincing at the time, and showed that in his so-called, quote, wait-and-see, close quote, treatment, roughly the same number of people suffering from pneumonia were cured or died as in earlier forms of treatment with time-honored remedies. The temporizing therapy established by Dietl and continued by Skoda was based on bringing the patient into a condition in which he was best able to stimulate the self-healing powers and to draw them forth from his organism. The doctor had little more to do than watch the course of the disease and to be at hand if anything happened, so that he could give assistance in a practical way. For the rest, he confined himself to watching the disease come, as it were, and waiting to see how the self-healing forces came out of the organism, until after a time the fever subsided and self-healing came about. This school of medicine was called, and is still called, quote, the nihilistic school, close quote, because it rested on a statement by Professor Skoda, who said something like, "We may perhaps learn to diagnose diseases, to describe them, perhaps even explain them, but we cannot heal them." I am telling you these things so that you may take note of them as actual developments in the course of the 19th century. My aim is to give you an idea of how views in this field have changed. But because these things are related in purely narrative form, it is not implied that you should take sides in any way. For obviously the statement of the celebrated Professor Skoda was a kind of radicalism, and it would be easy to define the limits of its validity. There was, however, one point or aspect which was repeatedly emphasized by this particular school of medicine. Although they had no means of proving it, and had not even the words to describe exactly the content of their conception, they repeatedly affirmed that there must be in the human being some element which determines the appearance and the course of his illness, and which is fundamentally beyond the reach of any help others can give. Thus a reference was made to something beyond human aid, and if one really gets to the bottom of these things, this indication cannot relate to anything other than the law of karma and its activity in human life. If we follow the course of an illness in human life, how it develops and how the healing powers spring forth from the organism itself, if we follow the process of healing impartially, particularly if we consider how in one case a cure takes place while in another it fails, we shall be driven to search for a deeper law determining this. Can this deeper law be sought for in the previous earth life of man? That is our question. Can we say that a person brings with him certain predispositions, which in one particular case called forth the healing powers from his organism, but which in another, in spite of every effort, held these forces back? If you remember what I told you yesterday, you will understand that very special forces indeed are taken into the human individuality in the time between death and a new birth. During the period in Kamaloka, the events of a person's last life, his good and bad deeds, his moral qualities, and so on, come before his soul, and through contemplating his own life in this way, he acquires the inclination to bring about the remedy and compensation for all that is imperfect in him and which is manifested as wrong action. He is moved to acquire those qualities which will bring him nearer to perfection in various directions. He forms intentions and tendencies during the time up to a new birth and goes into existence again with these intentions. Further, he himself works upon the new body which he acquires for his new life, and he builds it in conformity with the forces he has brought from previous earthly lives, and from the time between death and rebirth. He is furnished with these forces, and builds them into his new body. From this it may be seen that this new body will be weak or strong in accordance with the individual's capacity to build weak or strong forces into it. Now it must be clearly understood that a certain sequence of events sets in when, for example, during the life in Kamaloka, a person sees that in his last life he frequently acted under the influence of the emotions of anger, fear, aversion, and so on. These actions now stand vividly before his soul in Kamaloka. And in his soul is formed the thought, parenthesis, the expressions which we have to use for these forces are, of course, coined from the physical life, close parenthesis, quote, I must do something to myself so that I will become more perfect in this respect, so that in the future I will no longer be inclined to commit such actions under the dominance of my emotions, close quote. This thought becomes an integral part of the human soul individuality, and during the passage through to a new birth, it is imprinted still further as a force in the new body. Thus this new body is penetrated with a tendency so to act on the whole organization of the physical body, the etheric body, and astral body, that it will be prevented from performing certain actions resulting from the emotions of anger, hate, envy, and so on. The person will be impelled to fresh actions, which will compensate for previous ones. Thus, from a reason which extends far beyond his ordinary rationality, the person is imbued with a strong desire for a higher perfection in certain directions, and with the desire also to compensate for certain deeds. If we consider how manifold life is, and how, day by day, we perform actions which require compensation of this sort, we shall understand that when the soul enters into existence through a new birth, it contains many such thoughts waiting to be balanced, and that these manifold thoughts and tendencies cross one another, making the human physical body and etheric body receive a complex warp and woof of such tendencies and desires. To illustrate this, let us take a striking case, and I must again repeat that I avoid speaking from any sort of theory or hypothesis, and that when I give examples, I give only those that have been tested by spiritual science. Let us suppose that in his previous life, a person acted from an capital I feeling which was much too weak, and which permitted far too great an openness to the outer world, so great that it gave to his actions a lack of independence, a lack of character, which no longer fits the present state of humanity. Thus it was this lack of feeling of self which led him in one incarnation to perform certain actions. During the Kamaloka period, he had before him the actions which proceeded from this atrophy of his I, and from this he acquires the tendency, quote, "I must develop within me forces which strengthen my sense of self. In my next incarnation, I must seek for opportunities to strengthen this sense, to train it, as it were, against the opposition of my body, against the forces which will come to me in my next incarnation from my physical body, etheric body, and astral body. I must make a body which will show me the consequences of a weak personality." Close quote. The effect of this in the next incarnation will not fully enter into consciousness. It will run its course more or less in a subconscious region. The person in question will strive for an incarnation in which he will encounter the greatest opposition to his I consciousness, so that he has to exert these feelings to the highest degree. This striving draws him as if magnetically to places and circumstances where he meets with great hindrances, so that his I is stimulated into action in opposition to the organization of the three bodies. Strange as it may sound, the individualities who have this karma, coming into existence by birth in the way we have described, seek opportunities where, for instance, they will be exposed to an epidemic such as cholera, for this gives them the opportunity of meeting with the opposition we have described above. The activity which is thus experienced in the inner being of the person who is ill, owing to the opposition of the three bodies, can then so work that in the next incarnation his feeling of self will be much stronger. Let us take another extreme case, and to make the connection quite clear, we will assume the exact opposite. During the Kamaloka period, a person sees that he has acted from too strong a feeling of self. He sees that he must be more temperate as regards this feeling and that he must subdue it. So he will seek an opportunity whereby in the next incarnation his threefold organism will so condition him that his I consciousness, however much it strives, will find no limitations, and he will be led to the unfathomable and to absurdity. These opportunities come to him when karma brings him malaria. Here you have a case of disease brought about by karma, which explains that fundamentally man is led by a higher kind of reason than he perceives with his ordinary consciousness, two circumstances which in the course of his karma are favorable to his development. If we bear in mind what has just been said, we shall find it much easier to understand the epidemic nature of diseases. We could bring forward many different examples, showing how, because of his experience in the Kamaloka period, a human being actually seeks for the opportunity to get a certain illness, in order that by overcoming it and by developing the self-healing forces, he may gain strength and power, which will lead him upward on the path of evolution. I said previously that if a person has done many things under the influence of his passions, he will, in the Kamaloka period, live through actions which have also come about under such an influence. This will arouse in him the tendency, in his next incarnation, to experience some obstacle in his own body, and by overcoming this, he will be in the position to compensate for certain actions in his previous life. There is one illness in particular, known to us today as diphtheria, which frequently appears when there is a karmic complication of this kind, due to a lifestyle dominated by emotions and passions in a previous existence. We will deal with the causes of illness at greater length in the course of these lectures. But first of all, we need to take an even closer look at some of the fundamental principles involved to find an answer to this question: why is it that a person enters into existence through birth, equipped through his karma, with the tendency to achieve certain things by overcoming a particular illness? The fact that we are able to fall ill at all, actually to seek illness because of our karma, is connected with certain principles which we have often discussed already in our anthroposophical studies. We know that the luciferic forces entered human development at a certain point of the Earth's evolution. These are connected to beings which remained behind during the ancient moon evolution and did not attain, as it were, the normal stage of development on Earth. Owing to this, something emanating from these luciferic beings was implanted into man's astral body before his capital I was activated. So the influence of these beings was once exercised on man's astral body, and he has retained it throughout his evolution. This luciferic influence plays a part in human evolution. This luciferic influence plays a part in human evolution, but for our present task, it is important to point out that through the luciferic forces within him, the human being was imbued with something suited to tempt him to be less good than he would have been without the luciferic influence. It also gave him the tendency to act and judge more from his emotions, passions, and desires than he could have done if the luciferic influence had not entered. This influence produced a change in the real human individuality, which became more subject to what we may call the world of drives and passions than would otherwise have been the case. And it is because of this influence that the human being has become much more identified with the physical earthly world than he would otherwise have been. Through the luciferic influence, the human being has entered more into his body and has identified himself more with it. For if the influence of the luciferic beings had not been there, many of the things that allure human beings to desire certain things would not have arisen. Human beings would have been quite indifferent to these allurements, but allurements of the external world of the senses came through this influence of Lucifer, and human beings yielded to them. The individuality which was given by the I was permeated with the activities proceeding from the luciferic principle, and so it came about that in his first incarnation on earth, the human being succumbed to the allurements of the luciferic principle and carried these enticements with him into later lives. We can say that the way in which he succumbed to the allurements of the luciferic principle became an integral part of his karma. Now, if someone had taken only this principle into himself, he would have succumbed more and more to the allurements of the earthly world. He would gradually have been obliged to resign the prospect of breaking loose again from this world. We know that the Christ influence, which came later, counteracted the Luciferic principle and balanced it again, as it were, so that in the course of evolution the human being again received the means by which to rid himself of the Luciferic influence. But with this influence, something else was given at the same time. The fact that this influence had penetrated into the human being's astral body made the whole of the external world into which he entered appear different to him. Lucifer entered into the inner being of man, who then saw the world around him through Lucifer. His vision of the earthly world was thereby clouded, and his external impressions were mingled with what we call the Ahrimanic influence. Ahriman could only insinuate himself and make the external world into illusion because we had previously created from within the tendency toward illusion and Maya. Let me say that again. Ahriman could only insinuate himself and make the external world into illusion because we had previously created from within the tendency toward illusion and Maya. Thus, the Ahrimanic influence which came into the external world was a consequence of the Luciferic influence. One could say that when once the Luciferic forces were there, the human being enmeshed himself more in the sense world than he would have done without this influence. But in that he also created the possibility to absorb the Ahrimanic influence with every external perception. Thus, in the human individuality, which goes through incarnations on the earth, there is a Luciferic influence, and as a result of this, the Ahrimanic influence. These two powers are continually fighting in the human individuality, which has become their field of battle. Man, in his ordinary consciousness, is still exposed to the allurements of Lucifer, which work from the passions and emotions of his astral body. Also, he is subject to the enticements of Ahriman, which come to him from outside in the way of error, deception, and so forth, in regard to the outer world. Therefore, as long as a person is incarnated on the earth, with his mental images forming barriers, so that the influence of Lucifer and Ahriman cannot penetrate deeper, but is hindered by these mental images or ideas, his acts will be guided by his moral or intellectual judgment. When a person between birth and death sins against morality in following Lucifer, or against logic or sound thinking in following Ahriman, that concerns only his ordinary conscious soul life. When, on the other hand, he passes through the portal of death, the life of idea, which is bound to the instrument of the brain, ceases, and a different form of consciousness begins. Then all the things which, in the life between birth and death, are subject to a person's moral or rational judgment, penetrate down into the foundation of the human being, into that which, after Kamaloka, organizes the next existence and imprints itself into the formative forces which then construct a threefold human body. Errors resulting from devotion to Ahriman develop into forces of disease which affect man through his etheric body. Whereas misdemeanors, which are subject to one's moral judgment in life, develop into causes of disease which tend to originate in the astral body. From this we see how, in fact, our errors from the Ahrimanic forces within us, including such conscious errors as lies and so on, develop into causes of disease, if we do not merely consider the one incarnation, but observe the effect of one incarnation on the next. We see also how the Luciferic influences, in the same way, become the causes of disease, and we may in fact say that our errors do not go unpunished. We bear the stamp of our errors in our next incarnation. But we do this from a higher reason than that of our ordinary consciousness, from a consciousness which, during the period between death and a new birth, directs us to make ourselves so strong that we shall no longer be exposed to these temptations. Thus in our life, disease even plays the part of a great teacher. If we study illnesses in this way, we shall see unmistakably that an illness is a manifestation of either luciferic or Ahrimanic influences. When these things are understood by those who will practice healing according to the principles of spiritual science, their influence on the human organism will be infinitely more profound than it can be today. We can examine certain forms of disease from this standpoint. Let us take pneumonia, for example. It is a karmic effect which follows when, during his life in Kamaloka, the person in question looks back to a character which had within it the tendency towards sexual excess and a desire to live a sensual life. Do not confuse what is now ascribed to a previous incarnation with what appears in the consciousness in the following incarnation. This is quite a different matter. Indeed, that which a person sees during his life in Kamaloka will so transform itself that forces are imprinted in him by means of which he will overcome pneumonia. For it is exactly in the overcoming of this disease, in the self-healing which is then striven for, that the human individuality acts in opposition to the luciferic powers and wages a pitched battle against them. Therefore, in the overcoming of pneumonia, the opportunity is given to lay aside that which was a defect in the character in a previous incarnation. In this complaint, we see unmistakably our battle against the luciferic powers. The case is different in the so-called tuberculosis of the lungs, when we see the singular phenomenon whereby the self-healing forces become active and the harmful influences which arise are surrounded, encompassed, as it were, by something like connective tissue. This is then filled in with calcareous substance which forms solid inclusions. It is quite possible to have such inclusions in one's lungs. In fact, it is a lot more common than one would think. This phenomenon always points to a tubercular lung that has been healed. Where such a thing has taken place, a war has been waged by the human inner being against what the Ahrimanic forces have produced. It is a defensive process from within against what has been brought about by external materiality in order to lead to the independence of the human being in this special sense. We have shown how, in fact, the two principles, the Ahrimanic and the Luciferic, are at work at the very foundation of a disease. And in many ways it can be pointed out that in the various forms of disease one distinguishes essentially two types, the Ahrimanic and the Luciferic. If this were considered, the true principles would be discovered by which to find a suitable remedy for the patient. For luciferic diseases will require entirely different remedies from the Ahrimanic. Today, external forces are used for the purposes of healing in a way which betrays a certain want of judgment, forces such as electrotherapy, the cold water treatment, and so on. Much light could be thrown by spiritual science on the suitability of one method or another. If it were first decided whether a luciferic or Ahrimanic illness is being treated. For example, electrotherapy ought not to be used in illnesses which originate from luciferic causes, but only in Ahrimanic forms of illness. For electricity, which has no connection whatever with the activities of Lucifer, is useless in treating luciferic forms of disease. It belongs to the sphere of the Ahrimanic beings, although, of course, other beings beside the Ahrimanic make use of the forces of electricity. On the other hand, heat and cold belong to the sphere of Lucifer. Everything which has to do with making the human body warmer or colder, or that which makes it warmer or colder through external influences, belongs to the sphere of Lucifer. And in all the cases in which we have to deal with heat or cold, we have a type of luciferic form of disease. From this we see how karma works in illness, and how it works to overcome illness. It will now no longer seem incomprehensible that in karma there also lies the curability or incurability of a disease. If we clearly understand that the aim, the karmic aim, of illness is the progress and the improvement of man, we must presume that if a person, in accordance with the wisdom which he brings with him into this existence, from the Kamaloka period, contracts a disease, he then develops the healing forces which involve strengthening of his inner forces and the possibility of rising higher. Let us suppose that a person in the life before him, owing to his general constitution and his remaining karma, were to have the force of progressing during this life by means of that which he had acquired through illness. Then the healing has an object. The person comes forth healed from the illness, having gained what he was to gain. Through the conquest of the illness, he has acquired perfect forces, where previously he had imperfect forces. If through his karma he is equipped with such powers, and if through the favorable circumstances of his former destiny, he is so placed in the world that he can use the new forces, and can work so as to be of use to himself and others, then healing comes about, and he will find a way out of the illness. Now, let us suppose a case in which a person overcomes a disease, develops the healing forces, and then is confronted with a life which exacts from him a degree of perfection he has not yet gained. He would indeed gain something through the conquered disease, but for other karmic reasons he would not have gained enough to assist others. Then his deeper subconscious says, quote, here you have no opportunity of receiving the full force of what you really ought to have. You had to go into this incarnation to gain the degree of perfection which you can only attain in the physical body by overcoming the disease. That you had to acquire, but you cannot develop it further. You have now to go into conditions in which your physical body and the other forces do not disturb you, where you can freely work out what you have gained through the illness. Close quote. Such an individual seeks for death so as to use further between death and another birth what he cannot use in life. Such a soul goes through the phase between death and a new birth in order to construct an organization with the stronger forces it has gained by overcoming disease. In this way, through the presence of an illness, a payment on account, as it were, may be paid, and the payment is completed after passing through death. When we consider the question in this way, we cannot but recognize that there appear to be karmic reasons for the fact that some illnesses can be cured whilst others end in death. Looking at illness in this way will enable us to feel reconciled with life, as it were, in a very real sense, through the higher point of view engendered by this sense of karma. For we will know that the law of karma provides for the development of the human being, even when an illness ends in death. Even then, the illness's purpose is to support the individual's development to a greater state of perfection. Now, it would be inadmissible to conclude from this that there might be cases where one ought veritably to wish for a certain illness to end in death. It would be inadmissible for anyone to say such a thing, because the decision whether an illness is to be cured or not is subject to a higher kind of reason than that encompassed by our normal consciousness. In the world between birth and death, and with our ordinary consciousness, we must humbly desist from attempting to decide such questions. However, with our higher consciousness, we may, by all means, adopt a point of view from which we are able to accept even death as a gift from the higher spiritual powers. But we must not presume to occupy such a higher point of view with that consciousness which is given us to help and work in the world. We might easily succumb to error, and would then interfere terribly in something in which we must not ever interfere, the sphere of human freedom. If we can help a person to develop the self-healing forces, or support the work of nature ourselves, so that a cure may come about, we must do it. And if the question should arise as to whether the patient ought to live on further, or whether he would be more helped if he died, our assistance must nevertheless always be given toward healing. If this is done, we help the human individuality to use its own powers, and the medical assistance only supports him in this. Then it will not interfere with the human individuality. It would be quite different if we were to help someone suffering from an incurable illness to seek his further progress in another world. We should then interfere with his individuality and deliver it up to another sphere of influence. We should be imposing our will upon the other. Such decisions must be left to the individual concerned. In other words, we must do everything possible for him to be cured, for all the deliberations concerning healing must come from the consciousness which is appropriate for our earth, or else we should reach beyond our earth sphere, where entirely different forces come into play. Thus we see that a true karmic understanding concerning the curability and incurability of disease leads to our doing everything possible to help the person who is ill, and, on the other hand, helps us to accept with equanimity when a different decision comes from another sphere. This is all we need to do when we are confronted with such decisions. We need to find a point of view from which the incurability of a disease does not depress us, as though the world contained only what is imperfect and evil. Our insights into karma must never inhibit our will to heal. In fact, our understanding of karma will reconcile us to the hardest of destinies. Thus, we have seen today how the understanding of karma alone makes it possible for us to comprehend the course of an illness in the right way, and to understand that in our present life we see the karmic effects of our previous life. Detailed examples will be given in the course of our next discussions. We will now have to study the difference between two special forms of illness, those which come from our inner being and strike us rather more obviously as karmically caused, and those other forms of illness that appear to hit us by chance, through exposure to injuries from outside or involvement in some event or other. How can we extend our understanding of karma to encompass even things like falling under a train, for instance? How can we grasp so-called chance illnesses in terms of karma? The end of Lecture 4.